We'll call our meeting to order and welcome everyone here. We have two panels, and we are so grateful for our testifiers who are coming to help us understand what can be done, what is being done, and I think we have an excellent way to start this session. The business community is being a role model in Minnesota, and I so much appreciate that role model, and I think I speak for all of us when I say that. So with that, let me introduce Amy Fritigal, and she is going to lead off the first panel.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon to the committee. My name is Amy Fritigal, and I'm the Managing Director of the Sustainable Growth Coalition. The Coalition is a business-led partnership. We are a program area of a nearly 30-year-old organization called Environmental Initiative. The Coalition's founding vision is to advance the circular economy for the growth and prosperity of our region. Many people are not familiar with circularity, so I wanted to share how we think about it. A circular economy is a thriving economic system that values and preserves all types of capital. Nothing is lost or wasted. Resources and talents are utilized to their highest potential, and all inputs are used and then reused to continue to serve our needs in a cyclical fashion. The result of a functioning circular economy is a continuous positive development cycle that decouples economic growth from resource constraints. The Coalition embraces the circular economy as a path to ensure continued economic growth, drive business innovation, and enhance environmental and social stewardship. And you can read more about that in our two-page summary in your packet. We are a leadership group comprised of several dozen companies headquartered in Minnesota, as well as partners in the public and nonprofit sectors. We were founded 5 years ago when eight companies came to our CEO and asked for environmental initiative to help them go farther, faster together. We are committed to systemically approaching our work on energy, water, and materials through collaboration. Our members individually already have a major impact regionally, nationally, and around the world. But together, we know we can do more effectively to address natural resource scarcity and take advantage of opportunities provided by evolving customer preferences. Our members tell us that their top sustainability drivers are customers, investors, and employees. Their business case for sustainability includes creating new products, services, and markets, attracting and retaining top talent to stay competitive, growing job opportunities, advancing healthy communities, reducing operational and supply chain costs and risks, and promoting our region as a great place to do business and live. We're here to talk about the business implications of energy as it relates to the circular economy. And we're an interesting group in that we have both utilities and utility customers in our group. This collaboration is important because it's a team effort to work through the clean energy transition, requiring that stakeholders coordinate through these systemic challenges. The reason our members are here today is because of their enterprise-wide commitments to energy and climate. In your packet, you'll see a list of our members' corporate sustainability goals. The members here will elaborate on their own commitments, and these goals are what sparked our energy vision. So the Coalition members adopted a vision which states that we want Minnesota to be known for surpassing the state's current economy-wide greenhouse gas emission targets, increasing access to clean energy to improve racial, economic, social, and public health outcomes, and fueling economic growth for all Minnesotans. We are not intending to weigh in on specific legislation, but more generally, we support policies that will help realize a circular economy, including transitioning to lower and carbon-free fuels. Utilities in our area are increasingly announcing plans to deliver carbon reduction and carbon-free electricity. Our members have been supportive of Xcel Energy's efforts to make announcements about moving towards carbon-free energy. We support optimizing the energy system to increase efficiencies and leverage the necessary associated infrastructure to achieve our energy vision. We also prioritize electrifying the transportation sector, which is the largest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. Through a recent member corporate fleet survey, which is also summarized in your packet, we learned that the lack of availability of both charging infrastructure and model types in Minnesota are the primary challenges mentioned as members work towards fleet electrification. Therefore, incentives to electrify, access to more charging infrastructure, and vehicle availability were identified as priorities. Our members support fleet electrification because it is a business opportunity for innovation. So in conclusion, if you'd like to learn more, we hope you will join us on March 10th for our legislative breakfast to hear from even more companies. There's a postcard in your packet with more information. I appreciate you letting us share about the coalition's work today, Madam Chair. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Dr. Gail Schuler from 3M to hear more about their company's science-based sustainability leadership.
Good afternoon. Thank you all very much for the opportunity to be here with you today. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this better?
That is better if you put your name on the record.
Okay. My name is Gail Schuler. I serve as 3M's Vice President and Chief Sustainability Officer. And I'm delighted to be able to join you here as part of the Sustainable Growth Coalition and one of the founding members. As you know, as I believe you all know, 3M was founded here in Minnesota over 100 years ago on the North Shore of Lake Superior. And since then, we've been making commitments and advancing our efforts around sustainability. In 1975, we instituted a program that was revolutionary at the time called Pollution Prevention Pays. Now, today that's kind of obvious, right? We know that eliminating pollution is what we all need to do and the right thing for all of us as businesses and communities and governments alike. But at the time, it was inconceivable. My predecessor who introduced that program spoke before the United Nations, and was recognized very broadly by the EPA and others. What we need to realize is that when we're facing challenges in the world, oftentimes they start off as seeming impossible, and then they become more real over time. In 1990, we set our first publicly available sustainability goals, and they were bold and ambitious, doing things that we had never set out for publicly previously. And we've continued to set sustainability goals. In 2015, we set a set of sustainability goals that we also believed were bold, ambitious, and comprehensive. I'm pleased to tell you that some of those, like those related to climate and energy and renewable energy in particular, we've already delivered on the 2025 goals, and that causes us to be even more ambitious. So when we delivered on that, we started to do more. In 2018, in November, Mike Roman, our CEO, introduced our strategic sustainability framework at his first major investor meeting. That framework is about applying the science that 3M has and the energy of our scientists to help advance science and improve lives in many different areas. We have three pillars within that strategic sustainability framework. They're about advancing a global circular economy, so science for circular. They're about addressing climate challenges, both in our own operations and more broadly with our customers and communities beyond, so science for climate. And science for communities, because we believe that the biggest challenges the world faces are best solved through scientific advancement. Now, shortly after that, so it's science for circular, science for climate, science for community. I'm proud to say that with three C's in alphabetical order, there are people all around the world who can repeat them back to me. Right after that, at the United Nations Climate Summit, COP24, we launched a program or introduced a program that was our sustainability value commitment. Now, you all know 3M is a company with 55,000 products. That's the way we transform our enterprises, by introducing new products one by one. And we made a commitment that effective in 2019, every new product that entered our new product commercialization process must have a sustainability value commitment. I'd be delighted to tell you more about that because I'm very proud that our team has now achieved 100% of our products entering the new product commercialization process have sustainability value commitments. Now, they range from things that help electric vehicles be more, increase their range, to solutions that help others introduce more of a circular economy to their efforts, and to help the renewable energy industry. Some of them are better than others, so 2020 is about a year of continuous improvement on those. In February of last year, I mentioned that we had already known that by 2018 we had already overachieved on our 25% renewable energy by 2025. So we made the commitment at that time to increase from 25% globally to 50% of our global electricity coming from renewable sources. And that was the day that, through partnership with Xcel Energy, we switched our headquarters in Maplewood to 100% renewable energy powering all of our electricity across campus. And we further committed to our global electricity coming 100% from renewable energy. This is a big deal for a company that operates in 70 different countries and is a manufacturing enterprise. And we're doing a lot of work to help advance that cause. We know that climate change is one of the greatest changes we face as a community. That's part of what motivates us on this renewable energy commitment. We also know that through our products, we connect much more broadly through our customers and their sustainability footprints and what they can help us deliver from a climate perspective. So we do see it as critical for the business community to collaborate with their peers, the other companies, suppliers, and customers, and governments and civil society to support a healthy environment for generations to come. We have goals and commitments you'll see in your package around greenhouse gas emissions reductions, around energy efficiency or productivity, around renewable energy, and about how we help our customers reduce their energy emissions. We have further commitments in those spaces. I'd be delighted to tell you more about them. I've probably talked long enough now, but the commitments around advancing the circular economy, helping address all of our climate challenges, and making our communities more and more successful for the future are critical for us. We're all together on this, and we need the collaboration between companies, governments, and civil society.
Would you like to introduce your next?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Our next speaker will be Dan Scheibel, who's also from a founding organization of the Coalition Aveda, where he serves as the Global Sustainability Manager. Give me a chair flip-flop.
It's musical chairs. Madam Chairwoman and esteemed members of this committee, my name is Dan Scheibel, and I'm the Global Sustainability Manager at Aveda. So today I'd like to tell you a little bit about Aveda and Estee Lauder Companies, about clean energy, climate change, what it means to our business. I'll explain a little bit on our history and our company-wide commitments. And also provide you a perspective of what we're doing here at a local level in Blaine at Aveda's global headquarters and the impacts that that is having on our local economy and on climate change. I'll also give you a little bit of an update on what is going on within the Sustainable Growth Coalition and why Aveda and the Estee Lauder companies are investing in clean energy. Aveda started sort of like 3M in Minnesota about 40 years ago in Minneapolis. We've moved way up all the way to Blaine for our global headquarters and our primary manufacturing facility. So Aveda makes high-performance hair care and skin care products rooted in nature. Our products on average, and I brought a prop, are about 93% naturally derived. So what does that mean to us? It means that if we see drastic effects of climate change, our entire supply chain for our raw materials and ingredients is at risk. Aveda is a broad network of stores globally, and in addition to that, there are over 9,000 independently owned salons that are part of Aveda's network. They carry our products. So the subjects of climate change and clean energy are very important both to Aveda and to Estee Lauder. Over the past few years, the Estee Lauder companies have announced goals to achieve both net zero carbon emissions and 100% renewable electricity globally by the end of 2020. The RE100, or the Renewable Electricity 100, is a global corporate leadership initiative bringing together businesses committed to the purchase of 100% renewable electricity. Proud to say that Estee Lauder companies have already achieved 100% renewable electricity in the U.S. and Canada ahead of schedule. This was done in part by an investment in a 22-megawatt virtual power purchase agreement, a VPPA, that was done in Oklahoma, which will add renewable electricity to the grid. This agreement makes the Estee Lauder companies the first prestige beauty company to execute a VPPA and bolster the renewable electricity footprint. By the end of the year, the Estee Lauder companies will also set science-based targets covering scopes 1, 2, and 3. Just for a little bit of background for people that don't know about scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3. Scope 1 emissions are direct emissions from owned or controlled sources. So for us in Blaine, that is actually the burning of natural gas to heat our building. Scope 2 emissions are indirect emissions from purchased energy, such as electricity from Xcel Energy. Scope 3 emissions are anything else, indirect emissions, not included in Scope 2, that are part of our value chain. These can come from things like shipping our products, employee commuting, or the production of our raw material ingredients. So Aveda was the very first beauty company to manufacture its products at its primary facility with 100% wind power through renewable energy credits. We actually worked with Xcel, and since 2007 have sourced our power from the wind source program that they have. So we claim it on our packaging. And somewhere, it's on the actual side of this. And if you look at the monitors, you can see that we actually do take a pretty good investment in describing wind and wind power to our consumers and our guests. So the Estee Lauder's company's investment in reducing carbon footprint has actually allowed the facility in Blaine to invest in an on-site solar array. There are a couple people, the chair was up there about a week ago, and the array, once completed, is going to power about 50% of our annual manufacturing electrical needs. So what does that mean for us, and what does it actually mean for everybody else? Well, our solar developer is actually headquartered in Blaine. The fencing company that we're using is local. The landscaping company is local. So what's happening is all these companies hire people within the area, and they provide a fair number of jobs. I actually have a quote from our solar developer, Cedar Creek Energy. Solar in Minnesota has fueled consistent double-digit growth at Cedar Creek Energy and has created high-paying jobs. We're very appreciative that Aveda chose a Minnesota developer and installer, as this project keeps 18 people working for about 90 days. Partners like Aveda are key to the success of small businesses like Cedar Creek Energy. So clear statewide regulations, tax or financial incentives are beneficial to companies to actually be able to do these types of clean energy projects. From large wind power that takes place in the southern part or southwest part of the state to any of the electric vehicle charging stations that go up along I-35 heading north or south. It's really nice to have something like that. As I mentioned earlier, we're addressing different types of emissions. So we're not only addressing our Scope 2 emissions, but we're also addressing our Scope 3 emissions. So one of the things that we're actually doing at Aveda is we have installed electric vehicle charging stations, and employees, if they would like, are able to take advantage of the free electricity. So it's more or less like getting free gas. Not a bad deal if you drive to work and actually get free gas. All of us here are part of the Sustainable Growth Coalition, and we talked a little bit about the clean energy impact on climate change through electrification. So why is Aveda doing this? Why is this something that we're actually involved in? Well, this is core. This is our brand ethos. Environmental leadership has been part of our corporate DNA since our founding. And if we are not doing this, then our customers are going to probably go and find other companies that they view as being more environmentally friendly. That's not something we want to see as a business. There's a changing demographic of people buying our products. Millennials currently constitute about 30% of the U.S. labor force. And this is something that people really can't overlook if you're a business and you're trying to sell a product. We need to understand what their motivations are and be willing to meet them where they are with respect to sustainability. I hope that you can see that Aveda and Estee Lauder actually view clean energy and climate change as an integral part of their long-term strategy. From our work at Blaine, you can see the impact that it's having on local employers and how clear laws, regulations, and potentially incentives are going to be beneficial to companies going forward. And lastly, there's real benefits for companies. If we're focusing on sustainability, it's a good thing. Investment groups like BlackRock are making it part of their investment strategy. Consumers and customers are going to choose companies and those products that they believe to be more sustainable. And if our customers don't believe that we as a company are a sustainable company and we're doing the right thing, they're going to vote with their wallets. Thank you.
Great, thank you, Madam Chair. Our next speaker is going to be Shane Stennis, who serves actually as the chair of our steering committee for the coalition and is also the director of sustainability for the University of Minnesota.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Wagenius, representatives. Thanks for the invitation to be here today. Can you hear me okay? Excellent. My name is Shane Stennis. I'm the director of sustainability for the University of Minnesota. I'll sort of point out the elephant in the room. You're probably wondering why the university is on a panel that's supposed to be about business leadership. I assure you we're not a business. But while we are not one ourselves, we run our campus operations with the same attention to controlling costs and increasing value as many of our business sector peers. The university also has a great deal that we do that supports and furthers these private sector efforts to build prosperity through sustainability. So first and foremost, you know, the university, through our academic mission, is developing the human knowledge and knowledge capital required for these efforts to succeed. We're educating students and helping them build the skills and knowledge and competencies that will be required in the workforce to meet these challenges that you've heard from other panelists today. We're performing that critical research and discovery for insights and solutions toward a more sustainable future. And we're working with Minnesota communities through extension, through research and outreach centers to apply the best information and expertise to meet those communities' needs. I can't do justice to all the work that's happening across the U in these spaces, but we'd be happy to have university researchers, students, and instructors come back and talk about the in depth about the work that they're doing in these areas. I think second, and the primary reason I'm here today, is to talk about how we're advancing private sector efforts through modeling and demonstrating pioneering practice in our campus operations related to energy conservation, to renewable energy, and climate innovation that business can learn from and replicate. And that's that work that I'll highlight today. There's many reasons why we're implementing innovative practices on our campuses. You already heard from panelists, and you've heard before from university faculty and scientists about sort of the climate crisis and the urgency around climate change. And certainly, they are experts in the science, and I won't get into that today, but just know that that is part of what informs our efforts, is seeing sort of what the scientific literature is pointing toward and the level of urgency that's required for action. Part of that, too, is that we're also fixed in location. Unlike other organizations and businesses, we can't move. So if climate change brings catastrophic weather, if it brings catastrophic results that will impact our operations, we don't have the luxury of picking up the University of Minnesota and moving to Manitoba. We are, you know, bound in place in time and space to certain geographic locations around this state, and our communities that we're part of expect us to be there and to be present and be physically active and engaged in those communities. We're also a long-term institution, as you all know. We've been in existence for more than 160 years. We plan on being here for another 160 at least. And so we have to really think long-term about what's not just necessary in the next business quarter, but also what's not necessary in the next quarter century and beyond. We're also one of the largest energy consumers in the state. Our campuses consume an enormous amount of electricity and fossil fuels in order to keep buildings warm, to keep equipment powered up, to keep research facilities and hospitals and clinics operating at their full and peak potential, to educate students. And so in order for us to do that, we need to continue to have reliable and significant sources of energy for the foreseeable future. And then finally, we hear from employees, we hear from students all the time that they really want to work and attend institutions that resonate with their values. And one of the values that we know that our employees and our students hold is that organizations should do something about climate change. They should pursue renewable energy. They should be innovative. And so we do a lot of these things in response to what our students and our employees are saying as part of our talent retention and attraction process. So in terms of how we approach that work, though, we consider multiple criteria in how we evaluate and select solutions, and the actions we take are not evaluated through a single lens. We're constantly applying and balancing three core principles. First is cost effectiveness. We're really looking at, you know, sort of how much does a solution cost, not only in the near term, but also over the long term. We think a lot about total cost of ownership of our facilities and our operations, because we have to be good stewards of the taxpayer and tuition payer dollars that we're given. And so we really try to maximize every dollar that we have been provided. We also have to have reliability. We are a 24/7 operation. We have clinics, as you know. We have hospitals. We have classes that go well into the evening. And so those reliable energy services that can always be depended on are really essential for what we do. And where they also help us protect irreplaceable assets and safeguard billions of dollars of infrastructure that the university and the state has invested in. And finally, the solutions have to be sustainable. They have to achieve better environmental and social outcomes for all Minnesotans. So next, I'm just going to highlight a couple projects that demonstrate how we're doing this. So increasing rainfall, a tight urban site in proximity to the river, has led us to explore new strategies for how we manage and derive value out of the rain that falls on our campus. So far, we've installed 3 stormwater capture and reuse systems on the Twin Cities campus alone. One at the Harvard Street corridor, which is over by Pioneer Hall and the hospital. The second at the 17th Avenue Residence Hall. And the third pictured here at Athletes Village. These underground storage facilities or cisterns allow us to store potentially up to 8 million gallons annually, which we then use for cooling buildings and for flushing toilets on the campus. Excellent. Research labs are approximately a quarter of our space, but they represent more than 60% of our energy consumption. 2 years ago, we joined with 7 other universities in the Department of Energy to identify ways to bend the curve on energy consumption in research facilities. The program, called Smart Labs, will enable us to cut our energy consumption in labs by as much as 50% by changing the way we design and operate these facilities. The facility that's pictured on the right is the microbiology research facility, where we use sensors that detect chemical compounds, and then we continuously control the ventilation in the building to adjust and optimize the energy consumption that's in there. Doing this saves us money, it reduces energy consumption and emissions associated with that, and it enhances workplace safety. Finally, building components like heating and air conditioning systems and distribution equipment are significant consumers of energy. Sometimes these components fail to work as intended, leading to energy waste. Fault Detection Diagnostics, or FDD, is a type of software system that uses the thousands of sensor data points in our building automation system to detect these failures or faults quickly. We dispatch personnel to investigate, and then we're able to save energy by remedying the conditions before they persist for too long. So what has been the outcome of all this work and many other projects that we've done? Well, from 2008 to 2018, we've reduced emissions on the Twin Cities campus by 37% and 32% system-wide. Our goal is to reduce our emissions on the campuses 50% by 2021 and to become carbon neutral by 2050. And we're not just talking about building energy. We're also talking about the emissions that are associated with commuting of our employees and our students, as well as the air travel that our students and faculty and staff undertake throughout the year to go on study abroad programs, athletics travel, and research endeavors that may take them far out of the state and indeed across the globe. The results have also been achieved by lowering operating costs at the same time. Over the past 5 years, we've avoided $30 million in utility expenses through conservation, and we're saving more than $2 million a year by supplying our campus needs through less polluting technologies like wind, solar, and combined heat and power. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks by reiterating my appreciation for the invitation to speak today. We're really proud to be a member of the Minnesota Sustainable Growth Coalition and alongside these colleagues, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. Our last speaker will be Nick Martin. He serves on our Environmental Initiative Board of Directors and is the Manager of Energy and Environmental Policy for Xcel Energy.
Thanks, Chair Wagenius and members of the committee, for the chance to address you today. Nick Martin, Manager of Energy and Environmental Policy for Xcel Energy. In 2018, Xcel Energy was the first utility in the nation to announce a goal to reduce carbon emissions 80% by 2030 and provide 100% carbon-free electricity by 2050. Since then, over a dozen other major utilities have announced a mid-century goal that's either carbon-free or net zero. So Xcel may be leading the pack, but the good news is there's a lot of others following pretty close behind us. This reflects, I think, climate innovation, as in the title of today's hearing, but it also reflects that clean energy is simply a great investment, affordable, and it's in demand from our customers, communities, and investors. Our 80 by 30 goal puts us on track to achieve our share of Minnesota's Next Generation Energy Act goal for 2050 and do that 20 years ahead of time. As of the end of last year, we estimated we've already reduced our Upper Midwest emissions 42%, so well beyond what that statute targets for 2025. And by 2021, under our current plans, about 63% of all of our generation will be carbon-free in the Upper Midwest. Our concrete plan for achieving those goals in the Upper Midwest is the resource plan that we filed with the Commission last July. And you'll hear a lot more about that from my colleagues in a hearing tomorrow, so I'm just going to mention kind of the key components of it. An exit from coal in the Upper Midwest by 2030, 4,000 megawatts of new solar plus wind replacement, relicensing one of our nuclear plants, a significant increase in energy efficiency and demand response, preparing our system for more electric vehicles, and just enough natural gas generation to enable the coal exit and support a system that will be dominated by variable renewable generation. By 2030, the carbon intensity of the system electricity all customers get, even if they don't subscribe to any special product, will be in the ballpark of 200 pounds per megawatt hour, as compared to about almost 1,300 pounds in 2005. I want to emphasize that our plan is designed to bring low carbon, low cost, and reliable electricity to all of our customers under public utility regulatory principles of equity and non-discriminatory pricing. In other words, all customers will get 80% and ultimately 100% carbon-free energy with no cost shifting from some customers to others. Some of our customers want to go further faster, and the Sustainable Growth Coalition members are a great example of that, and we're enabling them to do so with products like Renewable Connect and WindSource, but still adhering to that principle of no cost shifts. While we can get to 80 by 30, we think, with current technology, getting rid of that last 20% will require new technology, specifically firm 24/7 carbon-free generation and long-duration energy storage technologies. So we're actively supporting federal innovation and R&D focus on a set of technologies including dispatchable renewables, gas with carbon capture and storage, hydrogen, advanced nuclear, and long-duration energy storage. We're not committed yet to any one of those technologies, but some combination of them will be needed to fill the role that natural gas plays today, but without the carbon emissions. Let me turn now to the Sustainable Growth Coalition. We've been a member of the SGC since its inception, and it's been a really extraordinary way for us to connect with our large customers to better understand their goals. Many of them, and an increasing number of the communities also that Xcel Energy serves, are setting their own sustainability, renewable energy, or carbon goals, and creating climate action plans. Some of these companies have set a goal to be powered by 100% renewable electricity. While we think 100% carbon-free is a better goal than 100% renewable at the system level, we can design such products for customers. And in fact, we've partnered with all three members of the panel today, as you've heard from 3M, Nevada, and also with the university on Renewable Connect. One of the things we're noticing is that as the carbon footprint of their electricity use declines, our large customers and communities are increasingly turning their attention to the carbon footprint of transportation and natural gas use. On transportation, we're working with the university, the state's Department of Administration, the city of Minneapolis on EV fleets and charging infrastructure. We're working with Metro Transit, also an SGC member, on the first electric bus route. On natural gas use, especially in residential and commercial buildings, we're rolling out a natural gas strategy that includes energy efficiency, beneficial electrification, renewable natural gas, and hydrogen. Here, the technologies are not as far along, and our cold climate presents some real challenges, but it's this kind of systemic issues that the SGC is really well suited to tackle. So let me close by saying Xcel Energy is ready to work with this committee and the rest of the legislature on any and all innovative ideas to speed the transition to carbon-free, affordable, and reliable electricity for all of our customers. And then look at ways to electrify other sectors where it makes sense to do that, or introduce lower carbon fuels in a way that benefits all of our customers and provides for a just transition. Thanks very much.
Members, this is the time for questions, and I'm so appreciative of all of you coming. The word I keep thinking, going through my mind right now, is overachieve, and listening to how you've set goals and have been meeting those goals and overachieving. So that's what I'm thinking about. Representative Long, do you have a question?
Do you? Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Scheibel, you mentioned the BlackRock announcement, which was pretty stunning to me, the largest asset manager in the world, right? $7 trillion has said that they're going to be using climate as one of the factors in their investments and divesting from certain fossil fuel assets. I'm wondering if you all are seeing this investor interest shift and how that's playing into your company's decision making.
Thank you, Representative Flom. For us as a brand of the Estee Lauder companies, we are not seeing that on a broader scale. Yes, that I think that you are seeing a large number of companies realizing that they have to up their sustainability game, that they're looking at impacts of climate change. And the interesting thing from Larry Fink and BlackRock was he was not looking at it and as just a he wants to do sustainability. He said, look, it's a financial risk. We're people that look at finances. We're looking at risks related to companies, their supply chain, being able to purchase whatever people need for their raw materials and their ingredients. And with a climate change, depending on where you are, it could adversely impact, you know, your ability to operate as a company.
Thank you, Representative and Madam Chair, for your question. This is the third year now in a row that Larry Fink has brought forward his investor letter about the importance of companies having a purpose. And this year he's gotten much more pointed and directed on climate change as being the challenge of our generation and the challenge of the coming years for companies and governments and civil society alike. We do hear that from our investors. I participate in calls, on average, I would say weekly, with our head of investor relations, speaking with various types of investors who want to hear what we're doing specifically about climate change. They want to hear about what we do in our own operations all around the world, what we do to help our customers address their climate challenge. I mentioned a number of different products where we help our customers reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and their carbon. And they want to know how we engage more broadly. We have installed solar and facilities from 3M Center to Corona, California, to Canada, to Tuas, Singapore. It is something that we are regularly discussing, and I've been hearing, you know, just even in February, we established a new committee on our board of directors. By our bylaws, we're only allowed to have four committees, and one of those committees is now science, technology, and sustainability. And as recently as this week, we've been discussing topics related to climate and sustainability with that group, because we know that it's an investor issue as much as it is sustainability for our own businesses, for ourselves, for our sources of supply, and what we do for our customers.
I guess if I could maybe just add from Excel's perspective, my group at Excel does a lot to help our CFO organization and investor relations respond to requests from investors, ESG-oriented requests. I would say, you know, 3 or 5 years ago, those questions would come from, you know, the California State Employees Retirement Fund or faith-based investor groups. They're certainly still coming from those groups, but they're coming from more kind of mainstream investors now. So we're seeing that trend. They're asking for more information. They're asking how our goals align with the science around achieving 2 degrees or 1.5 degrees. They're asking how our how we're making our system resilient to potential impacts of climate change in our states. They're asking us to look at kind of scenarios for how Excel would remain a profitable company and take advantage of investment opportunities in a new clean energy economy. So we're definitely seeing that trend as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Also wanted to follow up with Ms. Schuler on your 100% renewable energy commitment, which is outstanding and exciting. Curious what you see as some of the biggest challenges for 3M in achieving that goal.
Great question about, so thank you, Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. Great question about getting to 100% renewable electricity. From a global perspective, with operations in 70 countries, the infrastructure varies tremendously in the different geographies. Not everyone has a leading utility supplier who's stepping forward on that front. But we do consider sustainability when we select our locations. For example, in the last few years, we established our global service center based in Costa Rica, 99% renewable energy. Okay, we have facilities all around the world. We have mapped our energy footprint, our electricity footprint in every geography where we operate around the world, and we are engaged in exploring how we can make them renewable. Some of them it makes sense to do on our own facilities because of lack of infrastructure in the countries. We also map what the countries are committing to from a renewable energy perspective, therefore what we can expect from the overall grid. And we look at what the policies are that legislators put in place that make it more or less attractive for us to either locate in a specific geography or how we would approach putting renewable energy on our own sites or partnering with utilities or other types of approaches to get renewable energy. We definitely partner with our peer companies. Just yesterday, I had one of our large customers come to us and wanted to partner with us in a specific country that you would probably surprise you to help establish renewable energy, because we recognize that we all need to work on our own footprint, but how we connect, as a number of people have discussed, in that scope three that's beyond our own direct footprint as well. So there's a lot of activity going on in this space. It's moving faster than when I remember when I was involved in setting the 2015 goal, when we were involved in 2025 goal, and people just didn't think that it would be possible to get the amount of renewable energy. But that has changed so much in just the last few years. So I think it's a critical time and an inspiring time in our lives where I believe the energy grid is changing and will continue to change tremendously, globally.
One more.
Yes,
if you don't
Representative
mind.
Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For Mr. Martin, you mentioned that Xcel was the very first in the country to declare 100% clean energy as a utility goal. Somebody's always got to be first, but hopefully being first means that there are going to be others who follow your lead. And I'm curious if your leadership has opened the way for other utilities, if Xcel has been fielding questions from other utilities. I saw that Arizona made a pretty big municipal utility in Arizona made a big announcement, and how many are we up to right now that are committed to 100%, and what has been your involvement in sort of breaking the ice to lead the way?
Thanks, Representative Long, for the question. I think there's around a dozen. These goals are phrased in different ways, so it takes some interpretation, but if you're zeroing in just on, which utilities have set a goal that's either carbon-free or net zero by 2050, it's over a dozen. And as you suggested, yes, we've talked with a lot of them. A lot of these utilities reach out to Xcel to ask, how did we develop that goal? How do we analyze it in relation to the climate science? What is the resource portfolio that we think can get there? How are we evaluating some of the new carbon-free technologies that we think we're going to need, as I mentioned, to get there? So there's quite a bit of exchange among utilities that are considering similar goals, yeah.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the panel. I really appreciated Ms. Fredrigal, did I get that correct? In your opening statement, you talked about transportation and the fact that transportation is now the leading source of greenhouse gas emissions, and that can't be stated and repeated often enough because, interest, I think, in transportation and its relationship with climate change has lagged behind, electric utilities and other sources. And there was, a focus on electrifying the transportation system, particularly on vehicles, personal vehicles, which is very, very helpful. But I'm also wondering, in terms of public transit, how you are focusing on that, because that is a key way that people can reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector, and as well as land use. So, how, you know, are you locating your facilities in places where employees can take transit? How are you incenting transit? What is your overall view of that set of issues?
Well, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hornstein, for that thoughtful question. I think Nick Martin mentioned that Metro Transit, or through the Metropolitan Council, is actually a member, one of our public sector members of our coalition as well, which is great to have the private sector and public sector collaborating. We most recently conducted this member fleet survey, which we just submitted for you to take a look at, and we found a lot of opportunities and a number of challenges. We know that our members are working on exploring what they can do with their, let's call them corporate policies, to offer workplace charging, publicly-facing charging, and also electrify their fleets. So there's employee, public-facing, and fleet opportunities for electrification. And we know that's just part of the picture. So Nick mentioned the electric bus pilot that is a partnership between Metro Transit, Xcel Energy, and other stakeholders as well, in terms of looking at what the how to test out these technologies in our region. And through the more broader planning of the Metropolitan Council, with looking with at other communities and taking a broader look at the system, that's a good example of how we like to approach the issues that we look at. And so I think it's all a part and parcel of the puzzle in terms of how we can have access to the charging infrastructure that our members are interested in, as well as the vehicle model types, and help contribute to those solutions.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so first, I just want to start out by thanking you for all the good work that you all are doing. And I think that you have demonstrated both leadership and the importance of the work you're doing, because it does impact those that choose to attend your facilities or schools or choose to buy your products. And so in that picture, or in that vein, it's been touched on a little bit, but is it a part of your mission to mentor other organizations or businesses to help bring them along? You talked about partnerships. You talked about others reaching out to you and asking questions. Is there a part of your mission that is outreach to try and improve and pass that knowledge and best practices on to other organizations?
Madam Chair and Representative, thanks for the question. I can offer a few remarks, and perhaps others have thoughts as well. Absolutely, I'm glad you asked that question. That's a really big part of our mission, is to learn together and share out. And not all examples are always transferable, so just looking at lessons learned, sometimes you try and fail faster, and you know, so you pilot certain aspects or technologies or policies, whatever it might be, and really for the good of all Minnesota. So the approach of the coalition is to work at the societal systemic level, and so how can we have opportunities for growth for all Minnesotans? And so we really really try to share out what we've learned, that whether they be best practices or corporate goal setting or a piece of technology or a policy or perhaps something from other state or country. And so that's a big part of what we would like to do, is share that to other private and public sector members.
That's an excellent point. Thank you very much for asking the question. We're committed and engage extensively with other companies on their approaches. Whether, I would say the Sustainable Growth Coalition is actually an excellent example in Minnesota. We also have other organizations that we engage in with at a national level, Corporate Eco Forum and others like that, and from an international as well, groups like WRI or the World Resources Institute, or WBCSD, the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, where there's regularly leaders from those companies come together and have a chance to compare notes and learn from each other. Often we'll, you know, volunteer to host them here or visit them at their facilities. And it's an incredible learning, because very often these things are the devil in the details types of things, where you can say it at a high level, it's easy to make a big statement, but actually executing on all of those details to make it happen is incredibly challenging, but also the most important part. So you're right, partnering with others. And I think the Sustainable Growth Coalition is a great partner for the Twin Cities in Minnesota.
Thank Thank you very much for all of you for being here. It's great to hear about all these businesses and their transitions. And, of course, I know customer focus and the desires of customers are kind of driving a lot of your decisions. But I was curious if any of you could comment on specific products that you know that that's what customers are buying because of the green story that go along with them. And then also I was just curious to hear a little bit more of any of your endeavors with the electric charging stations. I know that Aveda, you said that you will offer that to people driving up, you know, your customers or your employees, and that's really important because to get this, get more people involved in electric vehicles, we need more stations out there. And we didn't make much progress on that last year here, so we need more of that from business. And I'm curious, especially with Xcel, if you have any programs on the horizon.
Thanks, Representative Bierman. Thanks for your question. So first, as a general answer, certainly, you know, the renewable energy programs that I mentioned in my comments are opt-in programs. Voluntarily, you can sign up to have 100% of your electricity be from renewables. So those are an obvious example of what you're talking about, people who are specifically interested in a greener product. And we try to design that, whether it's for, you know, a single house, a residential customer, or a customer as large as 3M, right? But to the second part of your question on EV programs, there's quite a lot that we're rolling out. I think the EV drivers don't only choose an EV because they've got a green sensibility. There's a lot of, you know, sort of cost savings, good performance. There's a lot of reasons to want an EV, but one of the things we find is that there are relatively few EVs on the road because of consumer awareness, concern about charging infrastructure or range anxiety, and just the upfront cost differential that's still there. I think that'll come down over time, but those are three barriers. So we're really designing our EV programs around enabling people who, you know, maybe some of them have an environmental objective, but some of them just are interested in the other benefits, enabling them to make that choice for an EV easier. So we're really trying to design our programs, you know, how can we help people know more about EVs, get more EV models available? How can we bring down the cost of charging infrastructure, make publicly available charging infrastructure available, whether that's on highway corridors or sort of community charging hubs, and then how, you know, are there mechanisms where the utility might be able to help in that initial cost of chargers or vehicles? We're certainly very interested in potential policy mechanisms around that.
Yes. Thank you very much. I actually love this question. So in 2011, I had a tremendous honor to be called to the White House along with 12 different companies from around the United States. And they were honoring us for implementing EV infrastructure. So there were companies like Google and Apple and Verizon and the who's who of the tech industry. And 3M was able to represent Minnesota because we had electric vehicle charging and we had signed on to a national electric vehicle program in 2011. Now, what was really fascinating to me at the meeting is I was able to talk with those folks. There was a lot of discussion about how do you set up your infrastructure. Well, the fact is, being an old company that's been around for a long time in a very cold climate, we actually had pretty good infrastructure because we had electricity flowing into our parking garages and parking ramps. So it was really fun to compare to those folks who were building new infrastructure. They were in warmer climates. So we had the infrastructure from warming. Oh, there are people here who are too young to know what I'm talking about. That's in the old days, you used to have to plug in your engine block to heat it up in the Minnesota climate. So we were the only one at that meeting who had any experience like that. And it was really fun to have that discussion with them. Now, we've since gotten much more modern in what we do. So we do have 22 different areas where we have one or more electric vehicle charging points across our 3M campus here in Minnesota. We have a number of different facilities from Austin, Texas to Neuss, Germany, where we also have electric vehicle charging. But what I'm most excited about, so that's really fun, but what I'm most excited about is that we have been, without calling it necessarily a greenhouse gas emphasis, we've been serving our customers to help them transition to electric vehicles for a long time. So part of what you need to do if you're transitioning to electric vehicles is you have to help address this issue of range anxiety. And the biggest factor that goes into range anxiety is the weight of the vehicle. So there's two pieces that go into that. One is if you can remove the engine, the motor, if you can remove the engine block that is the use for the internal combustion engine, you can lift a lot of weight. So by purely going to full electric and just having the motor, it's a much lighter vehicle. So that helps, and we've helped with many transitions associated with motor technology, many different unexciting products, but tapes and adhesives go into that. Also, if you switch the outer material of the body, so you've seen more and more vehicles switch from solid steel towards composites or to aluminum or technologies like that, you can't weld the same way. So 3M has been transformative with introducing adhesives that allow those electric vehicles to be much lighter weight. And then more and more, as a driver of an electric vehicle, more and more we appreciate the electronics that go into those vehicles and the interfaces that they provide. And some of the core products that make those electronics be reliable or have efficient energy life, those come from 3M as well. So we're full on into that, as well as things that help make renewable energy sites last better or be more efficient. It's a critical opportunity that we see for the future and part of that sustainability value commitment that I mentioned before. So thank you for the question.
Madam Chair, Representative, so in regard to your first question, yeah, in terms of products, you could think about sort of university degrees and experiences and educational programs as a product that the university is offering, and we certainly see students expressing increasing interest in programs that have a sustainability focus. In fact, I was just talking to one of the people who manages our sustainability minor, which is a minor that any student in any undergraduate program in any college can take across the Twin Cities campus. And they're seeing sort of record enrollments in their program this year because of surging interest in this topic. And I think it's a testament to, like, what are employers looking for in terms of the skill sets of their employees that are coming in as they exit their undergraduate programs. In regard to electric vehicles, the university has done a lot to try get ahead of this and enable electric vehicle charging for employees and the general public and a lot of our parking lots and ramps across all of our campuses in the system. The thing I will say we are, as Mr. Martin talked about earlier, engaged in Xcel's work around EV fleet pilots. And one of the things that we're starting to look at is, to disabuse a metaphor from Wayne Gretzky, right? So when he talked about how do you score goals, you look to where the puck is going to be and not where it's been or where it's at right now. And I think the same is true on the EV side. We're really trying to think about where EV is going to be 5 years out, so we're not building charging infrastructure that would be antiquated by the time, you know, EVs really hit their stride and become a major force in the automobile market. And with that, we're seeing longer battery lives, we're seeing faster charging speeds, we're seeing more charging that would be akin to like what you would see at a gas station, where you're fueling up rather than stopping and parking your car for multiple hours at a time. So I think that these are sort of what's emerging in terms of the electric vehicle market, and we're trying to sort of hit the right stride to think about how do we plan EV charging infrastructure for the university and support those efforts at the right place where the market will be as it advances into the future, and then what's the research that we need to do as an institution to help enable this transition.
Okay, I'm just going to ask a quick question about, especially the 3M, I think, and Aveda, packaging of your products, and if you have plans to maybe get away from plastics, and you know what your plans as a business are in that regard. Thank you,
Representative, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. So the packaging that we actually have sitting in front of you is about 95% post-consumer recycled packaging. So when you talk about sustainability, climate change, you know, the package, the product was actually made with renewable energy. The packaging is, you know, a vast majority of it actually comes from post-consumer recycled material. So, you know, the question of how are we getting away from plastics, what are we doing? you know, there's a trade-off on how you can do things. I could put glass and shampoo in a shower. I don't think that would turn out real well for a lot of people. One drop, and then we're going to have a lot of people with sliced feet in the shower. But what is an opportunity potentially for reuse? And can people take their products back and get it refilled at their favorite salon or at an Aveda location? You know, there's, again, it's going to be different products and where they're going to be used. There might be different opportunities. But we have done literally an industry-leading use of post-consumer recycled material. Literally, we have some bottles, the entire thing is a post-consumer recycled bottle, which you don't typically find that. You know, I think one of the big things, and I think everybody who is involved in just about any industry that uses plastics, is the worry about ocean plastics and ocean-bound plastics. And, you know, we are looking at, you know, the potential use of that or ocean or plastics bound towards the ocean, so potentially getting stuff out of, you know, the Mississippi River or other, you know, bodies of water before they actually hit the ocean. So we are looking into it, and you are right. It is something that, as an industry, we are addressing, and we're actually looking to partner with a number of the competitors to look at what are our opportunities for something like that.
So I think Aveda is a really good example of pulling the demand for recycled content. That is one of the biggest challenges. So we partner across the value chain on this as part of our Science for Circular pillar. And what our suppliers will tell us is that there needs to be a volume of demand and a recognition of what options are available or acceptable in the marketplace. You know, without giving away too much, with Aveda, you'll notice that this is not a shiny, clear example. This is my water bottle's glass. But it would be very challenging right now to make a shiny, clear bottle, and consumers often want that. So, yes, we're working with companies about using traditional recycling methods for plastics, but we're also working with companies around a new technology about chemical recycling. So instead of taking back the plastic bottles and crunching them up and then regenerating plastics, which, by the way, we do a lot of that with our packaging, every time you do that, it degrades a little bit. What the chemical recycling process allows, and it candidly is only available at the laboratory level today, but what the chemical recycling process allows is the reformation of carbon-hydrogen bonds in order to make essentially virgin-like plastics. So you can get the designer-oriented look that you want or the high performance that you need in some of our applications like medical, where we need to have the high assurance that there is not an issue with human contact. Some of those spaces require, very often 3M is chosen because of the performance of the material, so we have high requirements in the product itself. For packaging, we have a systematic map of our product portfolio, and we're going after each product one by one. We know where we have what level of recycled content, and we're working with each of them to advance the performance of those and to switch to materials that are more environmentally friendly in every way that we measure that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could add a little bit more flavor, too, from some other companies that are members that aren't here today. Some of them will actually be speaking at our March 10th event if you'd like to hear more. But we have a work stream in the coalition that we call our materials vision. And that's really about a couple examples that 3M and Aveda just shared, which is really starting with thinking way upstream from the product design, for thinking about, you know, what goes into the product. And that's a great way where you can really minimize way up front, and is a good example of circular economy. And then when it works its way through its stream, there's a lot of great reuse examples. I can think of two with Anderson Windows and Tennant Companies. Anderson Renewal, their future product is to really reuse materials in the product line. And Tennant has a refurbished floor cleaner products that are cleaned and reused and repurposed floor cleaners that literally are the same plastic that went into the product when it was produced however many years before. Those are good examples of thinking about take back, reuse, and designing upstream that have a big footprint benefit as well.
Members, are there other questions? I don't see any. I am certainly going to be thinking about the importance of goal setting. That has been a theme that you all have given to us, because you cannot achieve without that goal, and that's been important. You've also told us what's possible, and thank you so much for coming and doing that. We're going to be talking a lot about what you've said. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's our second panel. Jeffrey Seawall and Christopher Leaf. Welcome to the committee. Start by introducing yourself, if you would.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Jeff Seawald. I'm with Train, presently a part of Ingersoll Rand. Let me proceed by introducing my company and giving you a little background, and then I'll get into why we're here today. We're currently in the midst of a corporate transition from Ingersoll Rand to Train Technologies. With two key businesses in that portfolio, Train and Thermo King. Train has a significant presence in Minnesota, which I'll get into more, and Thermo King is a global producer of transport refrigeration systems based in Bloomington, Minnesota. Train's been in business for over 100 years, with its origins in Wisconsin, La Crosse, Wisconsin, where we've been manufacturing equipment for that 100 years. We have 40 years in building automation systems and controls, with our global headquarters for that business in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, and at least 25 to 30 years in energy services, including what I do every day, which is I go out and fix broken buildings, is what I tell a lot of people. I make buildings more efficient. I help renew the infrastructure. I put together projects that touch every system in a building, from roofing to windows to solar, to air conditioning, of course, which is what Train is originally known for. So here you can see we make pretty much everything that goes into a building. We make a lot of the systems that go into a building to make it comfortable and usable for its intended purpose. So ventilation systems, water chilling equipment for cooling large buildings and facilities, building automation and controls. We make energy modeling software. And the products on the right-hand side are all controls technology, and more recently, products that use data intensively and analytics in real time. And those products, again, based in our White Bear Lake facility, are intended to continuously optimize building performance. So we take existing buildings and make them work better continuously so that we're using less energy and keeping people comfortable and productive. Around the globe, just about one out of every, well, at least in the U.S., one out of every two commercial buildings has Train systems. We have 400 locations around the world, about 25,000 people, and we have 24 engineering and manufacturing locations where we make products, do engineering design, research, development. We serve all major markets. Here in Minnesota, we serve pretty much all those markets as well, everything from data centers to healthcare to education. In particular, I'll get into some K-12 and city government projects. So, in Minnesota, our footprint, we have our global controls headquarters in White Bear Lake. We have about 300 associates that work there. And those types of clean energy jobs range from technicians all the way up to software developers, test engineers, manufacturing technicians, and so forth. So a wide range of jobs. We have a training center there where we train a few thousand of our technicians from around the globe every year. And then we also have our Upper Midwest Region office in St. Paul. We have about 100 associates working out of that location. So, some of our customers include Minnesota institutions and businesses such as those seen here. This is just a small sampling. Colleges and universities. We work a lot in the K-12 space. More recently, I'm sorry, this seems to be advancing automatically. More recently, we completed the project at Allianz Field, which has train equipment and controls, where the Minnesota United soccer team plays. And then at Lifetime Fitness, we're completing construction on their new Edina Athletic Club, where we managed through a novel system application to cut the energy use of their typical fitness facility by 50%. So our contribution, a lot of times we work with utilities and use the Conservation Improvement Program incentives to benefit our projects. So you can see here, we've, over the last, since 2007, done about close to 500 projects and enabled about $5 million of incentives to flow to our customers and to help finance those projects. And that's just with our Xcel Energy customers. It doesn't include all the other customers, with all the other smaller utilities in the state of Minnesota. So I'm just going to highlight a couple projects. The Detroit Lakes Community and Cultural Center is a showcase and indicative of the potential in small cities across Minnesota. At this community center, we are working on energy savings of about $85,000 a year. Again, I apologize for the automatic advancement. We helped renew the infrastructure here, HVAC, building automation controls, some building envelope repairs, and we installed a thermal storage system. So this is important because there's a lot of talk about energy storage. Thermal storage is a proven technology used in a lot of buildings, especially in large cities, but finding more application now that it's very scalable and cost-effective. And we employed it here. So the building basically makes ice at night and uses that ice to cool during the day. So that reduces demand costs associated with that system and allows the utility to operate more smoothly without, you know, without, if more people use these thermal storage systems, the peak demand associated with air conditioning would allow utilities to be, the grid to be more resilient and reliable. I'd like to say we also partnered with Clean Energy Economy. If you want to learn more about this project, there is a good case study on their website about the project. We work with them, and I'll just make a plug for the upcoming Clean Energy Business Day on March 4th. So, at the Science Museum of Minnesota, another key project, again, highlighting another system that has a lot of potential across Minnesota. This project uses, at the heart of its system, heat recovery chillers from Trane. Those heat recovery chillers have enabled a 75% reduction in the heating energy and cost of the Science Museum. So we take energy that normally would have been thrown outside and wasted, generated by the core of the building, and we basically recycle it and use it to heat the rest of the building. So that building, again, benefited from Conservation Improvement Program incentives. And here you can see in the photograph on the lower left, at least my left, you can see we take every opportunity to take our projects and use them to teach the next generation about the importance of efficiency and sustainability in buildings. And that is what we're doing here with some of our K-12 customers. So, that's what I have for you today. I thank you for the opportunity to be here, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleague. All right.
Mr. Leaf.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak before this committee. I'm Chris Leaf. I'm the Director of Midwest Utility Programs for Wildan Energy Solutions. Some of you may not recognize that name, but I suspect most of you have heard of the White Group. The White Group in 2019 joined Wildan, and Wildan is a recognized industry leader with about $300 million in annual revenues. The affiliation that the White Group has now with Wildan allows the old White Group people an opportunity to expand opportunities for our local staff and extend our ability to participate in the exciting new frontiers that are emerging in the utility industry. Wildan's core energy and sustainability services feature electric grid optimization, energy planning, and of course, energy efficiency and energy design assistance. Wildan believed the White Group's innovative industry-leading tools were a perfect complement to their other portfolio of services, and we agreed. The broader nationwide team that we now are part of specializes in energy engineering, renewable generation, electric vehicle fleets and infrastructure, program management, microgrids, PACE financing, and other fields. Wildan services in this field have saved the equivalent of 5.4 million metric tons of CO2 and counting. Our Minnetonka-based division of Wildan has 80 architects, engineers, software developers, and other employees. That compares to a staff of 25 when I joined the company in 2002. Pretty nice growth. We collaborate with thousands of equipment manufacturers like Trane, technology vendors, specialty trades, building owners throughout Minnesota. Our expertise helps businesses across the state achieve energy cost savings, carbon footprint reduction, improve working environments, and increased profitability and productivity. As we gain more exposure through this Wildan affiliation to climate, energy and climate policies in other states, we are ever more thankful for Minnesota's forward-thinking policies. Consistent support for demand-side management programs allows businesses like ours to invest in people and products that keep our services cost-effective and relevant in a changing world. There is no doubt in our mind that the support provided by these programs has provided us with an advantage over competitors in other states. When we started our first SIP program 30 years ago, we did about 6 projects per year, each of which took about 12 weeks to complete. Now we do about 1,000 projects per year and provide the analysis in real time. That's what it takes to succeed in a world where people are used to getting answers on their iPhone when they want them. Furthermore, our initial efforts were focused on moderating the growth of summertime peak electric demand. With the environmental and economic opportunities associated with wind and solar generation and the economics that now drive these programs, the resulting priorities are changing. We are very excited about what this means for our industry, and we truly believe that we have some of the best utility clients in the nation and that their leadership is supported by strong and consistent policies which are fostered by programs like SIP and B3. In the coming years, advanced technology will be a key to sustaining growth in the Minnesota clean energy economy as the industry moves towards more renewable energy and self-sustaining grids. With the homegrown software development that we've done here, Wildan is very well positioned to develop the analytical tools that can capitalize on emerging technologies to fuel the future growth of clean energy opportunities. Our team looks forward to a bright future for our staff and all of Minnesota's clean energy industry workers. Thank you for the opportunity.
And thank you. How about questions, members?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks very much for these presentations, for the exciting work you're doing. Mr. Leaf, you mentioned the SIP program and the work that you've done in the state has helped expand your business and given you opportunities in other states. And I'm wondering if you could expand on that and talk about how Minnesota's positioning compared to other states has helped your business.
Well, certainly, yes. Now, again, the ability to understand that there's going to be the programs out there that are going to support the types of things to do has really allowed us to invest in the types of tools that enable us to do that work efficiently. So just having that confidence that program is going to be there in an ongoing way is really important. In some of the states that we work, that's not the case. They look at things on a year-to-year basis, and you really don't know from year to year what's going to happen. And it's much more difficult to commit, especially when we're dealing with, oftentimes we're trying to work with people early in the design stages of a building, for example. A building might not be done for 3 or 4 years. And so if you've got the certainty that you know that there's going to be that support down there, down the road when that building is done, that just enables a much more efficient level of planning and such. Again, not every state is like that, certainly. And so we've been able to point to the work we've been able to do here effectively through that and really think that that's been an influence in other places that we've gone for utilities and others to look at that as a good model for program development.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And The governor has convened a task force on commercial building efficiency, which I've been honored to be a part of. And one of the things that we've been discussing is how short the payback window is for a lot of energy efficiency improvements on new commercial buildings and certainly for retrofits as well. And I'm wondering if you can give us a sense for windows or HVAC technologies or some of the other control technologies that you work on. You know, what type of savings are your customers seeing, and what are the benefits?
Sure, Madam Chair and representatives, allow me to address that question. The paybacks range, of course. I'll just give you some examples. LED lighting technology, typical payback is anywhere from, I'd say, 3 to 7 years for most LED lighting projects. What we often do is package projects together to take those faster lighting benefits, faster paybacks, and blend them with the things that take much longer to pay back. So anything that's kind of a deep mechanical retrofit often takes somewhere between, I'd say, 10 and 30 years to pay back. So things like water chillers, boilers, air handling units, rooftop units, they all take a lot longer to pay back. So we often leverage the faster payback items with the longer payback items to get a blended payback that works for a project, like the City of Detroit Lakes. So in that case, the thermal storage actually turned out, because of the high demand costs associated with that municipal utility, the thermal storage actually turned out to pay back relatively quickly, like under 10 years. So does that answer your question? Yeah. Windows and roofing, those are much longer payback items. Those are typically beyond 30 years. So
I'll just briefly address that, too, if I could, Representative. A lot of our work focuses on new construction and trying to work with people during the early design stages. It's just much more cost-effective overall if you're trying to just address incremental costs as opposed to complete retrofit costs. So that's by far the most cost-effective time to try to work with people and influence their decisions when it comes to energy efficiency.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify, the payback numbers you were giving were for retrofits, not for new construction.
Correct, right? Yes. Yep.
And last question I have is, we've seen some pretty innovative projects in Minnesota on net zero buildings, deep dark decarbonization buildings, and I'm wondering if either of you of your companies have worked on projects like that and what you're seeing in the ability to get buildings to net zero in Minnesota.
So I work mostly in the retrofit space, and it's much more challenging in that space to get buildings to net zero. I wouldn't say it's impossible, and I often, as we're exploring the possibilities of a project, I often push our customers to consider the possibility of getting much lower in energy consumption. For example, that the Lifetime Fitness project, which actually was engineered by a colleague of mine, that project took a lot of convincing that so they would understand that system was going to work, even though it used half as much energy as their typical fitness center. So I think it often takes a lot of assurance to understand that the new technology is going to work and addressing the risks associated with that new technology. I think there's still a lot more that can be done to push things towards net zero. And I think new construction offers a little bit easier opportunity. I think the big question in Minnesota is, what do you do about all the heating and natural gas? The electricity is a bit easier in a sense, because especially a lot of people with goals to get to net zero electricity are being very much helped by Xcel's work, Xcel Energy's work in doing that. So they only need to make up the other 10 or 20% that Xcel is not going to provide renewable energy or carbon-free energy. But natural gas, to me, that's where one of the bigger questions is, what do we do about all the heating?
Yeah, I guess in terms of net zero buildings, it's the technically possible, yes. The economic possible is the broader question. You know, there's an approach you take when you've got that goal set up front, which is very important. Try to do whatever you can to minimize the loads in the building, and then choosing efficient systems to meet those loads. And then you've got a lower target to hit when it comes to what you're trying to do, whether it's on-site generation or something like that.
I don't see any other questions. You've given us a lot to think about, though, and I certainly, when you're talking about the natural gas issue, there's a lot that we need to be thinking about, so I appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We have one person signed up for public comment. Priya Najmi. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative, or Chair, and thank you, Representatives. You have to pardon me. This is my first time testifying, so I might be nervous, but bear with me here. I'm Puya Najmi. I represent, I'm the Policy Director for Cooperative Energy Futures. We're a cooperative renewable energy producer. We specialize in what's called community solar gardens. And just as a very quick background, because I'm going to need to get into this as I go here a little bit later, a solar garden would be a remote facility that people subscribe to that are either renters or for some reason cannot afford or just do not want to put solar panels on top of their house. So they can still get the bill credits through Xcel Energy for their bill. And this allows them to participate in the renewable energy economy, as well as mitigate climate change and mitigate pollution. So with that being said, I'd like to highlight, because this is about innovation here, what we are innovative how we are innovative at Cooperative Energy Futures when it comes to renewable energy. The first thing I'd like to highlight is that we are not a big business, and I appreciate all the businesses that came today and shared their information. We're in full support of all their efforts towards this. But what we are is we're a cooperative owned by the people. So if you're a member, you're a part owner, you get to run for the board. I'm a member. I'm also chair of the board. But the rest of the members are not employees of our cooperative either. The other important thing to realize about a co-op is that all of our profits in excess of going into development go back to our members. So that's another important thing to realize about a co-op. Now, what makes us different? Because, you know, Minnesota co-ops are a dime a dozen, which is a great thing, right? We're kind of the leaders of co-ops here in the country. Well, we're a little bit different because we're a co-op with a mission. And here's some of the parts of our mission that are innovative, at least as we think they are. So first of all, we concentrate on serving low to moderate income residents. And not just low to moderate income residents, but residents in underserved populations and people of color. So we actually go after these people. We go to their churches, we go to their community centers, and not just in the core metro area, this is also in greater Minnesota to a large extent too. What we also do is we do not discriminate based on credit. We don't even check credit. We don't discriminate on income. We don't discriminate on anything. So you're automatically signed up if you want to sign up. Immediately you save money. There is no upfront cost whatsoever. And like I said, no barriers to access whatsoever. So as long as we can produce a garden, you can sign up for it. And you can. And the other big thing about it is, like I mentioned before, because we're a co-op, you actually get dividends. So you get paid. So not only are you saving money on your electricity bill, but as we go on and as we make money, you're actually getting a dividend on top of that. Then on top of that, you have control. So you can run for the board. You can make decisions. We have yearly annual meetings where every single member is invited, and we have satellite meetings in greater Minnesota where you can participate. And you can give your word as to how it is controlled, how your energy is controlled, which we believe is extremely important for not only giving people power, but giving them agency and educating them as to how they can actually affect both our environment and how they live, how energy affects how they live, and how much power it can give them as citizens. So that being said, another great thing about our business here is we're a developer, right? We develop these gardens, and we hire installers. We require all of these installers to hire at least 50% people of color when they are installing these panels as well. So that's another thing. And we prefer that these people are from the community as well, when the people who are getting the power. So for example, our flagship garden is in North Minneapolis. It's on Shiloh Community, or Shiloh Ministries, I believe it's called International Ministries, on Broadway Avenue, West Broadway Avenue in North Minneapolis. It serves about 200 residences, all in the area, and about half of that crew are people from that area that built that garden as well. So that being said, 50% people of color, and also our terms, just simply the terms of our solar garden and how it works. There are other companies that do it, and we have much respect for them as well, but they're private companies. They're not cooperatives where the people own them. And so it doesn't make sense for us to make terms in which we're making a whole lot of money up front, because it's going to go back to the customer. So our terms are the best in the state, pretty much. I mean, this is actually borne out in a study by Gabriel Chan from the University of Minnesota, where he compared all the contracts across the state for all CSGs. And our terms were the best because we're owned by the people and because they have a say in our terms as well. So that makes a big difference. We currently have about eight gardens. We have eight gardens. We have about 700 residences in those gardens. The majority of what we try to do is concentrate, like I said, on residential customers, not commercial customers, not industrial customers, no credit checks, no barriers to there's no barriers to access to entry for any of these gardens whatsoever. So in conclusion, what I'd like to say here is that we are highly, highly encouraging and supportive of our community solar garden program in Minnesota right now. We'd like it strengthened rather than weakened in any way. But on top of that, I'd like to stress that there's a different way of doing community solar and renewable energy, and that's the way we're doing it. It's where the equity, meaning the money, the power, the control that's gained from these remote facilities in which are creating power, are actually owned by the people. And that's what we're doing here at Cooperative Energy Futures, and we just like to let everybody know that that's a new innovative way that can also be done, and we'd like to press that more in Minnesota. So thank you.
Members, questions? I don't see any questions. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Members, I'll tell you what we're going to be doing tomorrow and also on our first hearing that will be coming up on the 13th. Tomorrow we're going to spend an hour talking about long-term contracts between co-ops that generate electricity and those that distribute it. That's not a lot of time, so if there are other people who would choose or want to testify, please let Mike Molzan know, and we will arrange for a time at a future date to have additional testimony. Then that's the first hour, and the second hour plus, maybe Representative Long would like to talk about that because he is arranging that part.
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair. And the second hour, we're going to have Xcel Energy coming in to update us about their integrated resource plan.
On the 13th, we are going to look at the impact of climate change on Minnesota waters. We're going to start off with Dr. Mark Seeley. He's going to update us from the information he gave us last year when he also started us off. We will hear from five other experts, including one on wastewater treatment, impacts of climate change, on our stormwater system, on drinking water across Minnesota, and then just some broad what's happening to our geology with climate change, and then we'll have a representative from the Fond du Lac Nation. So that's going to be our first hearing, science and data, and that's the way we started last year, and that's the way we're going to start this year. With that, members, I don't see any questions or comments, and we are adjourned until tomorrow at 9 o'clock.